My name is Talia Smith, and you're listening to Season 2 of Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast. There are stories all around us. We tell stories every day. We watch movies, we consume internet content, and we talk to people. How could we communicate without stories? I think it's impossible. This season, my friends and I will be telling stories that will leave you spooked, uneasy, or even on the edge. Join us for Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast, Season 2. This story was recorded in Maryland and tells the story of a 19th century emo kid. Enjoy! Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast. You're here at Season 2, Episode 1. Thank you guys for coming back and tuning in. I'm so excited. I'd like to start by introducing our first guest of the season. We have Ezra Paler. Ezra is an animator, illustrator, and lover of creative writing who grew up in Sykesville, Maryland. After studying animation and cinematic arts at UMBC, he now works as the in-house animator for Early Light Media, a video production company that uses storytelling to capture the human experience. Say hello, Ezra!
Hey, everyone!
A reason why I'm so excited to do this podcast, and this is really special and personal, is Ezra and I have been friends for over 15 years at this point, and a majority of our friendship has revolved around storytelling.
It really has. It really has.
We're going to be telling a really fun story, a very, again, pretty close to home in a way. So Ezra, would you like to tell us 3 fun facts for today?
Yes, I would. So today we're going to be talking about Edgar Allan Poe, who is really a fascinating figure, not just because of his acclaim in Baltimore for his poetry and his literary legacy, but also because there's just so much mystery that surrounds him. And we're going to focus in particular on that and some of the interesting drama that sort of surrounded his death and his later life. Fun facts about Edgar Allan Poe is, for one thing, he was originally born to parents in the performance business, and then he was actually orphaned. So another fun fact is that the football team in Baltimore, the Baltimore Ravens, was actually named after his poem, The Ravens, which I actually, for the longest time, didn't know, which is kind of nuts. So I think it's the kind of thing a lot of people might know it, and a lot of people might not.
The mascot of the Raven is Poe. Ba-dum-chow.
And fun fact number 3 is that before Poe's death, he was actually found delirious in the streets. And there's been a number of different theories about what ultimately took his life. He was discovered to have swelling in the brain, but why and how he actually did die at 40 remains undecided. There have been speculations that it was a flu-related death. There have been speculations that he was assaulted and had head trauma. And there's also been speculations about carbon monoxide poisoning. So quite a lot of mystery around that as well.
So we're going to talk more about Edgar Allan Poe in just a second. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, just want to say we are not experts on the subject. We're just fans of Edgar Allan Poe, who did a lot of research, who loved telling stories, and most importantly, live for the drama that is Edgar Allan Poe's life. Why are we telling this story now?
Well, for one thing, I always start to think about Edgar Allan Poe's stories around this time of year. We have the colder weather coming, that like spooky chill that goes through your neighborhood. You know, that always sort of gets me in that mindset where I like to talk about these mysteries and these scary things that are sort of in this realm of the unknown. So that definitely seems appropriate. Also, I just think it's really telling how, in this particular story, someone's reputation is so based on, like, the press and just people's created recollection of who they are. And I think that there's a lot of ways that that happens today. And I think there's some interesting parallels to explore there, too.
Yeah, what happened to Poe is very relevant to today. On that note, let's briefly kind of introduce who Edgar Allan Poe is for those who don't know.
So Edgar Allan Poe was an American writer and poet who authored The Raven and other famous works of mystery and macabre, and he's become quite the iconic figure in local Baltimore history. He was actually born, though, in Boston and raised most of his life in Richmond, Virginia, but he did later take residence in Baltimore, and he ultimately died there as well. He's actually buried in Baltimore in the Westminster Presbyterian Church Cemetery, which is right on West Lafayette Street. And interesting story is the site of his grave alone has actually attracted some mystery among Baltimoreans. We have the Poe Toaster, who is an anonymous visitor who every year on Poe's birthday comes to the churchyard and he'll leave roses and a glass of cognac at his headstone.
Yeah. So if you're not intrigued by that, then let's start telling the actual story. And Ezra, would you do the honors of saying my favorite phrase, once upon a time?
Once upon a time, Edgar Allan Poe was born to two actor parents. They were actually traveling actors, and this was in Boston in 1809. But within a few years, both of his parents unfortunately died, and then he was taken in by a tobacco merchant, John Allen, and his wife. And they lived in Richmond, Virginia, so he spent a good deal of his childhood there.
Which is kind of crazy because, you know, when you think Edgar Allan Poe and you're from Maryland, and I understand not all of our audience is from Maryland or even from the States, but if you're from Maryland, you just assume Edgar Allan Poe is also just like a full-on Baltimorean, but he is not. It's just like, yeah, kind of a Baltimorean.
And it's wild because there's an Edgar Allan Poe house museum experience you can do in Richmond, Virginia. And I went there in high school and you get to see his writing desk and his inkwell. And I believe it's one of the houses that he resided in at one point. And they even have a lock of hair in a glass case. I don't know. It's either his hair or one of his lovers. But there's, you know, so there's that part of his life there for people to visit and experience. But if I hadn't gone there, you know, in high school, I might not have known he was affiliated with Richmond.
And we will get into his lovers later because, oh boy, does he have them. And yeah, I didn't realize that he didn't primarily live in Baltimore until I went to Boston with my family a few years ago. And in Boston, they have a statue of him. And we were kind of confused, like, why in Boston? And we're like, oh, he was born there. Super weird. Also, totally tracks that he had actor parents. Like,
yeah,
for no reason I can explain. I'm just like, yeah, of course his parents were actors. Like, that makes
and
sense to me.
It's sort of yet another mystery. Like, everything in his life almost seems like it could fit into one of his poems or stories. It just seems like, you know, very par for the course with his life and I dare to say his brand. You know, it's funny that, I mean, of course not funny that there is that he was orphaned, but it certainly kind of sets up an interesting stage for his life.
Yeah. And from what I understand, like, his adoptive family was not an ideal situation and that his siblings were split up and sent to different people.
Yes. Yeah, I believe that is correct. I think he had a brother and sister who went to live with other families, and his adoptive parents really wanted him to be a businessman and go into business. But from his childhood, he really wanted to be a poet. He was very interested in writing. He had, you know, childhood heroes that were famous poets, and he really was not interested in the tobacco business at all from a young age. So that sort of set the stage for some tension with his family.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the typical story. Like, I just want to be an artist. It's like, no, that's not a financially viable career. But I love the art. Reading, I remember that he was into Lord Byron, which...
Yes.
You know, I just, again, another one of those things that feels typical. Like, Lord Byron is another one of those characters who we're actually going to talk a little bit more about later on in the season that has a mystery and this, like, weird, dark, romantic side to him that just... Again, this all just tracks. Like, you think this emo artsy figure from the 1800s It's Poe. That's who he was.
Yeah, and that's what's so interesting, too. Like, if I were to ask you, Talia, like, what is, if you had to describe Edgar Allan Poe to someone, like, you know, the research aside, just your cultural impression of who he is, what would you say?
I would say Poe was an artsy, fartsy emo with an alcohol problem. That's just kind of what I thought about it. And when you first, you know, read the foundation of his life, it tracks.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was in high school, I was really particularly into Poe and his poem Annabel Lee, which I honestly haven't read now in quite a few years, but that poem just really struck me back then. And I think I was certainly very much like this, you know, or I at least perceived myself to be this moody, artistic sort of person. And I think that impression of Poe kind of made me feel like, oh yeah, this guy like creates this work that understands something about me. And I don't know, like today, if I would necessarily feel that way to the same extent, but it's interesting at that point in my life when I was like 14, 15, and I was really kind of nebulous in who I was, it really called out to me then.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny too, because and this is a little bit of a tangent, but when we were planning these episodes and I knew I wanted to do an episode on Poe, you were the first person that came to mind. I was like, who could talk about Edgar Allan Poe? Ezra. Ezra could talk about Edgar Allan Poe. He went to college, went to the University of Virginia, but his stepfather did not really pay for his college. He was just expected to go. So he had to drop out because he couldn't afford it. And then his fiance broke up with him, which sucks. And then he was pretty much forced to go into a military school, West Point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he did not thrive there.
No. And we can relate. We wouldn't thrive at West Point either.
No, I certainly don't think I would.
From what I understood, when he found out his fiance was two-timing him, so basically, I guess I should explain, his fiance was his childhood sweetheart, and when he went to college, she married somebody else. So he found out that she cheated on him, so he was heartbroken, and then he didn't have any money to pay for school, so he was poor. And then he's this artist, so he's this poor, heartbroken artist forced into military school.
Oh, yeah. And something that I read was that he would actually have to burn some of his furniture to keep himself warm at a certain point in his schooling. So he was really in a position where, you know, he was so focused on the material necessities in his life that he wasn't able to have met that, you know, I mean, I can only imagine, you know, so many people have that situation. And then, you know, you have school and the academic world on top of it. And especially if it's something like, you know, you're not even passionate about, like in this case, that's just nuts to have to.
And the fact that it's like his stepfather, in a way, if not forced, strongly encouraged him to do this and then didn't support him while doing it is so disappointing.
Yeah.
And he definitely had the, from what I understand, like his stepfather had the means to support him if he wanted to. He just chose not to. Is that the impression you got?
Yeah, because it certainly seemed like they had money, you know, in his childhood. If I'm not mistaken, it seems like, you know, his father being a wealthy tobacco merchant, you know, I can't imagine there wouldn't have been that generational wealth that would have been able to support him. But I also have a feeling that regardless of the funding, I don't know how long Poe would have lasted, you know, someone like him who's a writer and really, you know, a creative. And, you know, I can't imagine that he wouldn't have ultimately ended up leaving that life path anyway, but it's certainly disappointing the way it turned out.
That's true. I mean, that's true. It definitely probably sped up the inevitable.
Yeah.
So he went to West Point, right? He gets to West Point. He's like, what, 18, something like that. And he writes his first book, if I'm not mistaken, Tamerlane. Is that right?
Yes, Tamerlane was, I believe, his first book. I'm not sure exactly what it was about, but I know that it was around the time he was enlisted in the United States Army, and he was writing and publishing poetry during his time here. So it's interesting because, like, he was sort of living out his father's dream for him while also on the side, you know, sort of still embarking on his own path that would later be his ultimate choice.
And to nobody's surprise, he did not make it in the military.
Nope.
And that's kind of where he gets to Baltimore for the first time.
Yeah, he was just kind of, it seems like he was kind of desolate, and he went there, you know, to try to reach out to his relatives in the city. And luckily, he had an aunt there that kind of was like a mother to him and welcomed him into their family. So he did sort of get to experience that family connection after what seemed like such a tumultuous time with his adopted father and these expectations in the military academy.
So a little bit about his aunt, Maria Clem, just so we have some context. We have Aunt Maria Clem, and Aunt Maria Clem was related to his Edgar Allan Poe's late father, his biological father. And by the time Poe came into her life, she was living with her own mother and her young daughter, Virginia. They didn't have a lot of money. She was living off of a $240 annual pension that was given to Aunt Maria Clem's mother on behalf of Aunt Maria Clem's father, who was a British sympathizer during the American Revolution, right? So we're here in, you know, the early 1830s is the time period we're talking about, and they're surviving on a Revolutionary War pension from the losing side. So already pretty brutal. And Poe's brother, because remember we mentioned that he had a brother and a sister, his brother was actually raised by Aunt Maria Clem when all the siblings were separated. His brother went to live with Aunt Maria Clem. When Poe moved in with them, his brother died in 1931 from tuberculosis.
Because I was curious what their relationship was like being separated.
It's so sad because Poe visited Aunt Maria Clem and Virginia and Maria's mother in 1829 when the brother was still living. And then by 31, the brother died. And by 32, Poe moved in. So that's our timeline here. Now, my opinion, this probably was a mistake on Aunt Maria Clem's part to let Poe move in. Do you know where I'm going with this?
Yeah, was it the case that her young daughter, Poe took an interest in her romantically, and that was certainly a complicated situation, I would say.
Yeah. So if you've heard of Edgar Allan Poe, you've also probably heard that he married his cousin. And that cousin's Virginia. And that cousin was 14. And Edgar Allan Poe was 27. And if that just doesn't yell, yikes, 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 and I don't know what does.
It's definitely complicated when you come across something like that in someone's history. It's like, you know, how do you really contend with that and you know, who they are in the cultural imagination and who you've revered them as growing up?
Especially coming from, like, our world right now, it's gross. And then, obviously, absolutely, you can't just not look into this situation. I mean, especially me, like, I was like, oh, I have to learn more. I have to understand why he would marry his 14-year-old cousin. Obviously, he's a pedophile, but, like, why? And so I was doing a lot of research on just that relationship. And I don't want to dwell on this, but some say, you know, that he was more, like, taking care of her like a father would, and that they never consummated the relationship, and that he guided her education and was tutoring her, and that he really looked at her, you know, less like a romantic partner. One even said friends indicated that the couple did not even share a bed until Virginia turned 16, which is still too young. Not justifying any of this, but it is, I don't know.
Yeah,
I feel like it needs to be said.
Wild is that, I guess, like, we'll never hear from her, you know, what it was like for her. I wondered, like, to what degree she had, like, agency in that decision to be in that marriage. I wonder what the feelings were on her end. And I definitely think about that a lot, because that's sort of, like, lost to history. We won't really know her inner thoughts on what it was like to be married to this guy that was, gosh, when you're 13, you know, you're a child, and like this man that's almost 30, like, it, you know, we won't get to hear from her what that was like.
And when you read the secondary sources on it, you know, articles have a specific narrative they're trying to get across, and the articles are either like, he was a pedophile. I'm not saying he wasn't, but it's either trying to talk a lot about him being a pedophile, or it's the article trying to talk about, no, he was a father figure. So, like, how do you contend those two narratives? I don't know. It's tricky. Read the secondary sources yourself, audience, and you come to your own decision. But I think it's all just gross and sketchy.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, there's stuff about him that it's like I said, it's interesting to contend with and to sort of, you know, like, appreciate his aspects of his literary legacy. But then, you know, you don't really know who someone was as a person, or like the impact they had on the people around them. You just sort of know them by their work, and that could be for better or for worse in a lot of cases.
Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit more about reputation a little later on.
Oh, yeah.
So back on the course of his life.
So he did get his start with writing at this point, and he found work eventually writing for magazines, and what he would write would be these short stories. He eventually did get a job at the Southern Literary Messenger back in Virginia, and he really sensationalized the magazine while he was there. And the content would seem to be Tumblr quality for the 1800s. And they wrote a lot of scathing book reviews. They were, you know, by the parlance of our times, they might be considered as trolls, you know, like internet trolls. But Poe would ultimately end up trolling the wrong guy, Rufus Griswold.
Yeah. Everything I read about Edgar Allan Poe is just 2010. I don't know.
Yeah, it's really interesting, especially once we get into the drama with his nemesis / friend. It was very back and forth.
His frenemy.
Yes, it's interesting how, like, there's this talk about, like, internet drama or various, you know, people on the internet slandering each other, and it's considered to be, like, exasperated by technology, which I think is, you know, absolutely true in part. But I think that, like, it's funny how these dynamics have just always existed between people since the beginning of time, you know, at least in the cultural context that we're living in, that basically back then they were having these feuds, and, you know, they were using public forums to drag each other down, and there, you know, I'm sure there were people in the middle of it, and it's just kind of interesting how that plays out in a parallel way, but also so vastly different.
Oh my gosh, I agree. Like, I love reading. I have a subscription to the Baltimore Sun Archives, and yeah, guys, I'm a dork, and sometimes I just read the society section for the drama, because there's so much drama, and they just will call people out, or, you know how they say the teens feel bad because you'll post something on Instagram and you'll know you're not invited to a party? Well, in the olden days, people will put out a newspaper article about who was and who wasn't invited to a society party.
Wow, so, that hurts.
Is that brutal?
That's very brutal.
Everything old is new again.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I've been thinking about this a lot. If Rufus Griswold and Edgar Allan Poe had the technology at their disposal that we have today, I wonder how they would have utilized that against each other.
This is going to be a deep cut. Those who know, know. I feel like if they would have been if you've been paying attention to the Jeffree Star versus James Charles drama.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like that would be them.
I was thinking of James Charles. I was this whole time. I've been thinking of James Charles. I don't know. I don't know. I'll be honest. Like, I want to go on record and say that I've been super busy lately. I really haven't, like, examined that drama. I don't, like, really feel like I have, like, a formulated opinion on it. I just know that James Charles is kind of a funny guy, I guess.
I think you said it perfectly, and I'm gonna echo that and say I also haven't really been keeping up with it, but I love to hear the bits and pieces that I hear. It's just entertainment.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I kind of feel like these situations where people do have a platform, or, you know, like a following, and that sort of can become a tool for good or bad. And I think that's what happened between Poe and Rufus Griswold quite a bit.
I agree. The content Poe is putting out, I would say, especially with the Southern Literary Messenger, I don't want to say he wasn't a nice guy, but he was definitely very critical and pretentious. He wasn't going out to make friends.
And I know that, like, time goes on, the way that the language has sort of been presented in writing has changed. You know, like, if you read something from, like, 100 years ago, it's most often going to be hard to follow for us today at a certain level, just because of the way it's worded and the way the language is. But I feel like even with that aside, I do feel like some of his writing, it lends itself to read and understand very well. But other pieces of his writing, like, I kind of feel like I can't really delve into this all the way, because I hate to say maybe pretentious is the word. It's sort of...
So he made a career out of it, though, and he was a household name by 1845 when he released The Raven. In my opinion, The Raven's probably his most popular work.
It's definitely, if you think of, like, the icon and symbolism of him culturally, you always see him with a raven on his shoulder.
Yeah. So 1845 was kind of his big year. But unfortunately, his wife died of tuberculosis in 1847. And we've had a lot of episodes with people dying of tuberculosis, which is just tragic. So if you want to learn more about tuberculosis, like I said in the Anton Chekhov episode, if you go back to season one, watch Moulin Rouge, learn about tuberculosis and how terrible of a disease it is. Mm. But she was young. I mean, she was young when she died. And Poe took the death really, really hard, obviously. Yeah. He ended up, by 1849, getting back together with the girl who two-timed him when he was a teenager, and they got re-engaged.
Interesting. It's interesting how it seems like his movement between cities is tracked to things going particularly bad in his life. I mean, it's not necessarily that that's, like, an uncommon thing for someone to change cities or, like, relocate when things get bad enough that they just feel like they have to, but it's just interesting that he sort of goes between cities at these crucial points of his life when things are just kind of awful for him.
Yeah, it seems like he tries to escape his problems and he's never able to. And I think the best example of that is, at this point, he was engaged to his first love, for lack of a better term, after the death of his child bride. And before the wedding, Poe intended to go to Philadelphia, but he made a pit stop in Baltimore. I have a quote, and I'm going to, as you guys know, I'll give all of our sources at the end and we'll put them in the show notes. So I'm just going to read the quote that I have in my notes because I think it says it all really well. It says, "He stopped in Baltimore on the way there and disappeared for 5 days. He was found in the bar room of a public house that was being used as a polling place for an election. The magazine editor, Joseph Snodgrass, sent Poe to Washington College Hospital, where Poe spent the last days of his life far from home and surrounded by strangers. Neither Poe's mother-in-law nor his fiancée knew what happened to him or knew what had become of him until they read about it in the newspapers. Poe died on October 7th, 1849, at the age of 40. The exact cause of Poe's death remains a mystery." And that's what you talked about in our fun facts. His birth is a mystery and his death is a mystery.
Yeah. It's sort of like he entered and left this world both out of and into mystery. I guess it was not particularly uncommon at that time for the cause of someone's biological death to be unknown or to be, you know, unclear medically. But the fact that there were just so many theories about it is really interesting. I think from what I gathered in my research is that the one consensus is that it was related to an issue in his brain.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was a brain tumor or brain trauma or an infection that had affected the brain or something related to his alcoholism, you know, whether it could have been any of those things or it could have been something else.
When I was talking to my dad about doing this episode, we're having a chat just before we recorded this. And I mentioned that we were going to do about Edgar Allan Poe. And he goes, you know, I think he was murdered. And I don't think he died of alcoholism. I think he was definitely murdered. I was like, oh, let's talk about his death conspiracy theories. Because even all these years later, you can still fall into like what we're doing now. What's your favorite conspiracy theory of how Edgar Allan Poe died?
Well, I guess I didn't really realize there was sort of like a niche conspiracy theory group that discussed his death. That's super cool.
I don't know. Maybe it's just my family. I don't know.
His work was so much about this mystery, and it's so much about death. Yeah. It sort of toes this line between reality. There's supernatural things that happen in his work, but it's masterfully subtle. And that even, I think, enhances the mystery of it.
I agree.
And I think that the fact that his death is almost like this quiet mystery that is just sort of sitting there in his history. Like if you look at his biography, you can find it. But, you know, it's not really like a commonly known thing that his death is a mystery.
Yeah. Well, and we haven't talked about the content of his work. We're not really going to get into the content of Poe's work. But the trailer for this season was a reading of The Raven. So I do encourage our listeners, if you want to get a sense of that kind of creepy, mystery, tragic Poe writing, to check out the trailer of the podcast where I read The Raven. And it's very creepy. It's very, very eerie. We'll link all of his stuff in the show notes so you can kind of read it and get the sense of what we're talking about with this. So what we do want to talk about a little bit is Rufus Griswold, the rival of Poe. And the important part about him is how he constructed Poe's legacy.
Yes. So Rufus Griswold and Poe were actually friends for a good bit of time. They were both in this world of poetry and literature, and Poe was a critic. And at some point he had criticized a publication that Rufus Griswold released that was basically a collection of poetry. And he essentially accused Rufus Griswold of basically just selecting his friends as the people in this collection. And it was sort of based on that personal relationship rather than like the actual merit of their writing. So that was received as a very scathing insult by Rufus. So he then in turn ended up making these jabs at Poe in later memoirs and collections of poetry and like reflections that he published on Poe's writing. The two of them would have these interactions where they would, one of them would slight the other's reputation, but then they would kind of make up. Like Poe would send a letter to Rufus Griswold explaining that, you know, my criticism wasn't an attack on your character. It was just an attack on your literary judgment, or, you know, something like that, which I'm sure was still, you know, insulting, but I guess it was sort of his way of trying to mend the personal a little bit. Yeah. Rufus Griswold would actually sometimes lend Poe money to save his magazine.
When Griswold published his obituary of Poe, it is so insulting. If somebody wrote an obituary about me, like he wrote about Poe, I would be rolling in my grave. So let's read just some of the claims that he made. And the claims that he made would in turn create the reputation we have about Edgar Allan Poe in our mind, right? Like this obituary gave Poe a reputation that he didn't have in life.
Right, absolutely. What Rufus Griswold did was really take those things that Poe was dealing with in his life and really blow them out of proportion to the point that it colored his whole reputation for, you know, basically a century to come. And some of those claims include that the reason that he left his university studies was because he was kicked out due to drinking and gambling. When, you know, as we were discussing before, it was actually the financial issues that really put that pressure on him that he couldn't continue his studies. And, you know, the family tensions as well were a big part of that. So he just paints Poe as this person who was always in a state of drunkenness beyond self-control and had reckless appetite for gambling and you know, was just reckless with money, when that really wasn't necessarily the case according to other accounts of who he was.
Yeah, other things that he claimed is that Poe deserted the military when he was actually discharged, and that he was a very unstable and unhinged individual. And he also claimed that Poe was a womanizer. And that's something I think is interesting to just mention when we talk about crafting a reputation. Because while Griswold demolished Poe as a human, you know, it is true that Poe had a lot of women in his life. I don't want to get into each affair just because we're running out of time. But I think it's fair to say, first of all, Ezra sent me something today, which is interesting, that they actually shared a lover at some point, Fanny Osgood, who was a writer. But a lot of Poe's former lovers that he had throughout his life were actually the people who tried to save his reputation after he died, which I just find just so fascinating. An example is one of his lovers was Sarah Helen Whitman. She was in a relationship with him towards the end of his life. And she would challenge people who slandered Poe's character. And she wrote a complimentary biography of his life, praising him and his literary achievements. One of his other lovers, Annie Richmond, would defend him in death and try to defend his reputation. And obviously, his fiance, Elmira, his first love, took an active role in his family after he died and really tried to redeem his name in death. So that's something I find fascinating. This man who had this child bride, a slew of lovers, just weird relationship with women in general. After he died, the woman kind of came out of the woodwork and was like, he was actually a nice guy and doesn't deserve this hate. And I just find that it just adds to the mystery of, like, who was this complicated individual?
Yeah, that is very mysterious. It's unusual. I, you know, growing up, you know, I did read a good bit of Edgar Allan Poe, so I had that connection to his work where, you know, I had this degree of reverence for him as a creator. But even so, like, I kind of had this idea of him as this sort of morose person, this brooding, gloomy person, that at least outwardly, that's sort of how he appeared to people. But actually, some accounts say that he wasn't even necessarily like a desolate or moody person, really. Like, he loved piano, and he had, you know, this sense of humor that he wasn't really that caricature that we sort of imagine culturally, with like the huge bags under his eyes and you know, really an image that sort of plays a lot on the way that we've kind of like disenfranchised things like addiction and mental illness, and just how those have been so stigmatized. I think the image of him really has played on that too.
You're totally right. Like, we're gonna, in the show notes and on our social media, we'll share some images of Edgar Allan Poe, because Ezra attached some of these to our research, and I think they're definitely worth looking at, because this image that we have, like, exactly what you said, and he looks older too. Like, these images of Poe make him look like this old, old man, but he was 40 years old. That's young.
Yeah, like this image here where he's just sitting at a table looking super bleak with this glass of wine and all these ravens around him and a candle, and his eyes are like sunken into his head. Like, I feel like that's the image in our collective imagination, you know, as a society when we think of Edgar Allan Poe. But a lot of that may have been influenced by something as seemingly simple as slanderous obituary. So it's wild how that sort of echoed throughout time.
Yeah. I think it just kind of shows how complicated human beings are and how these brilliant people can be both brooding and dark and mysterious, but also have light and joy in their lives, even if we don't see it right away. And even if it's not what they write about, nobody's all one thing. And I think we forget that in 2020, there's so much just darkness around us. And we have to remember, like, not one person, not one thing, not one event is all darkness. That's just not how the world works. Even Edgar Allan Poe, there was light in him.
Yeah, and what's interesting too about him is that I feel like because he's this famous figure, he's a little distant from the reality of humanity in a certain way. Like, there's absolutely a dark side to him and things about him that are very complicated and do not paint a favorable light on his character. Like, for example, the child bride, and he was also against the abolition of slavery, which is suggested, you know, some of his publications, and also, like, there's definitely racist themes in quite a bit of his writing. And I think that, you know, growing up in the antebellum South, that was a part of his perspective. And you know, something like that, it's like, it makes so much sense because of the way that our history has been formed. We didn't think about that growing up, that he has these parts of his history that just don't align with the way that we revere people.
Yeah. We didn't even get into his connections to the antebellum South, but we mentioned that, you know, his stepfather was a tobacco farmer in Richmond, Virginia. And if you're familiar with the Civil War, Richmond, Virginia was the capital of the Confederacy. And I also mentioned that his family was loyalists in the Revolutionary War. So they kind of have a trend on being on the wrong side of history. I'm going to attach links that talk probably more intellectually than we could about Edgar Allan Poe and the racist themes in some of his work and his pro-slavery sympathies. But yeah, I think it just adds to, like, the layers a person can have and how easy it is to erase elements of a person we don't like to preserve their work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially, you know, when you grow up with someone as a figure and their work has had a place in your life and your growth, and then you sort of contend with these other realities and complexities about who they are, it's definitely something I think a lot of people are going through with a lot of different figures from history. And I think it's, you know, it's definitely for the better that everyone really contends with that and reflects on it.
So our internal theme of the season, when Emily and I are talking about the season, we talk about how we want the stories of season two to make you feel on the edge, make you feel uncomfortable in a weird way. And I think Edgar Allan Poe, why we wanted to start with him is because he kind of exemplifies that. Not only does his work make you feel on the edge when you read it, but his life is so layered and bizarre and mysterious that it just inevitably makes you feel on the edge.
Absolutely, absolutely. And something so interesting to me that I discovered in my research that I never, you know, had any clue about as far as Edgar Allan Poe's body of work is that one of the last things that he wrote was this book called Eureka, which was sort of like this philosophical piece about, you know, the nature of the universe, sort of went into like transcendentalism and like everyone sort of being connected spiritually or universally. And he actually considered it his most important piece of work, in his opinion, out of everything he had put out into the world. That was what he sort of held most closely as being the most important which was really fascinating to me because I never really would have expected that was a direction he was interested in. I certainly like had never really done much research or musing into his philosophical or spiritual or you know, scientific perspectives. I certainly had never really even considered those in and of themselves, but I didn't really imagine that for some reason he would be sort of into this mystical sort of spiritual base of thought. But it kind of makes sense with some of his poems, like, you know, like A Dream Within a Dream. It sort of speaks to some of those concepts. So I think that it is interesting, like, knowing that now, to look back at some of his other pieces of work and maybe see some different types of connections with some of the language and the imagery.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope that this podcast episode can act as a launching off point for people to look more into Edgar Allan Poe's life and work. This episode was definitely a lot of Ezra and I just kind of gossiping about Poe's life, but I promise you, we did do our research for this, and we do have a lot of resources to share with you. And if you are already into Edgar Allan Poe, which I know a lot of our listeners probably are, I just want to make you aware of October 3rd and 4th. This episode is being released on October 2nd, so October 3rd and 4th is kind of perfect timing if you're listening to this on our release date, is the International Edgar Allan Poe Festival and Awards. It's 2 days of books, music, and art streaming live online at the virtual Death Weekend Poe Places Tour, Poe and Film and Fashion, live exhibit, virtual tour. I'll put the link to that in our show notes. You can also find it at poefestinternational.org. Again, that is October 3rd and 4th, if you're interested. It's streaming, it's online, and it's sponsored by Poe Baltimore. So that's something to look into.
Very cool. Very cool.
We will link to Poe's work itself in our show notes, some articles that we've read, some of the biographies that we've read as well, just so you guys get a stronger idea of who Poe was. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Ezra. I really appreciate it. I had fun. I hope our listeners had fun, but I had fun. This is a great time.
My spooky orange light on.
Oh, I love it.
And my purple light too. So I'm like Halloween Raven mode.
I love it.
Yeah.
I always like to give our guests a chance to plug themselves. So do you want to plug your Instagram or anything like that before we go?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for that opportunity. So I'm an animator, as you said, and an illustrator, and I post a lot of my work on Instagram, which is just Ezra Paler, all one string of words. So you can, if you're interested in checking out my animations, you can follow me on Instagram.
And if you don't already follow me on Instagram, you can totally do that at just_Italian. And again, what you just witnessed was some childhood friends who grew up telling stories, who found career in storytelling,
and grew up gossiping.
Grew up gossiping.
You know, it's true.
It's true. Just kind of going off on Edgar Allan Poe. So yeah. I feel like this was a very on brand hour or so for us.
Absolutely. And before we go, can you tell us a little bit about, I saw you post something today about how we can buy you and Emily a coffee.
So Buy Me a Coffee is a great program for creators of all sorts, where instead of asking people to like, can just give me money, can you give me money so I can support my endeavor? You can ask people to buy me a coffee on the platform. One cup is about $5 and it goes right to the podcast. It helps support us afford the platform and our other podcast expenses, so it doesn't come out of our pockets. So if you're interested in doing that, the link is in the show notes. Yeah. And also before we go, Ezra is our featured artist of the week. For the advertisement of this episode, you've seen Ezra's art already if you follow us on Instagram or on Facebook. This season, we have a featured artist with every episode, trying to promote, you know, local art and artists, because we're all artists right now. We're all struggling. COVID has definitely been a blow, so we definitely want to make sure we can support each other during this time and give each other some free ad space where we can.
It's so important. Absolutely.
Thank you, Ezra.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's been so fun.
Once Upon a Time, a storytelling podcast, was produced by Talia Smith and Emily Joba. You can buy us a coffee to support this podcast at buymeacoffee.com/onceuponatimepc. And special thanks to the contributions from Jacob Wasserman, Sharon and Anthony, and Maureen Paler. Our guest today was Ezra Paler, and our story was that of Edgar Allan Poe. Our featured artist, which you can see on Instagram, is also Ezra Paler. Our music is Photos of a Murder by John Bartman. Our Instagram is at A Storytelling Podcast. And our email is astorytellingpodcast@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook, too. You can listen in on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Links to all of our resources are in the show notes and on our website. The end.